But I get the privilege of wrapping up our James series this week. And we are, just as a reminder, maybe you've missed it, maybe you have forgotten, but the entire book of James, if you've read the book of James, it kind of feels like James is just throwing haymakers. He's just throwing gut punches. It's like every line is, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And we're in the fourth chapter of James, and there's five chapters. If we read the book of James, it's sometimes it's easy to walk away and say, look at all of the things I have to do, and James is telling me to do and not to do. But really, the purpose, to remind us, the purpose of the book of James is to remind us that the same thing that we say here in North Central is that when the gospel transforms us, it is a whole life, full life, every area of life transformation. It's bringing every area of our lives under what we're going to talk about today, which is the submission to God to live the way he is inviting us and telling us to live. Conversely, if you were to read James, sometimes you might walk away and think, it's just a list of things that I'm going to do. If I do all these things, then I'll be good. But we are going to look at a passage in James 4, verses 4 through 10 this morning, that provides a very beautiful and instructive metaphor when we think of, well, how do I actually live a faith that submits to God? And James informs us and nestles a beautiful little metaphor in here that revolutionizes and builds a foundation, is the center on how we actually live all of these things that he is telling us to live, and the way in which he is inviting us and exhorting us to behave, right? So if you turn me, go ahead, James chapter 4, verses 4 through 10. This is ESV. He says, "You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is no purpose that the Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us? But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourself before the Lord, and he will exalt you." Some more haymakers from James. But there's a whole list of wonderful exhortations in there, right? Humble yourself, submit yourself, resist the enemy, draw near to God. All these beautiful exhortations, which is keeping in line with the way James is written. But there is a beautiful, we're not going to look at those specifically, we're going to look at the very beautiful first word that he lays in there, that James does something beautiful as he gives us and presents us and reminds us of a very key relationship that we have with God. And this is what he says. In our English translation, it says, he starts with, "You adulterous people." Now, if you read that, you don't say, what a beautiful, thank you, James. What a beautiful start to this little passage, right? But it's beautiful because James is not actually exhorting the people. He's not saying you're all committing literal adultery with your spouses. He's not saying that to everyone. The original Greek translated is just one word, and that one word is this, adulteresses. James is telling every believer who reads this passage that we are wives, unfaithful wives. And what is James doing? He is pointing to a beautiful metaphor of our relationship with God, and that is the metaphor of marriage. He is going to help us say, how do I live a life submitted to God? Well, it is a remembering of the fact that we are in a marriage relationship with our beloved in heaven. And it is out of this metaphor that he's going to lay the foundation or the center of right living so that we can actually do the things that God is asking us to do. Now, there's a lot of metaphors in Scripture, right? The king metaphor, you might think, if I were going to be telling someone that how they should submit and live a life, I might choose the king metaphor, right? That's a very unique relationship that I have with God. He's our king, so I will submit to all the things he tells me to do, right? That tells us a very unique thing about our relationship with God. Maybe you choose the shepherd and the flock metaphor, right? It's what does that tell us about our relationship with God? He's a very loving, caring shepherd. We are sometimes dumb and wander around, and we're kind of stupid sometimes. We wander away, right? But he lovingly shepherds us, right? Maybe that's what I would choose if I were to say, how do I submit and how do I want you to live in line with what James is asking us to do? But no, he pulls and he points to the marriage metaphor. And this is one of the most important and central, and Dr. Timothy Keller says, the most sublime metaphors of our relationship, and it tells us something very unique about our relationship to God. And again, this is all throughout Scripture, this metaphor. It goes back, if you read the book of Hosea in the Old Testament, an entire book about this relationship between the metaphor between God and his people, God being the groom and his people being the bride. And what does he tell Hosea to do? He says, go marry a prostitute, an unfaithful wife, and essentially you're going to feel the pain that I have as a prophet to say, this is what my people are like. They are an unfaithful wife. You look forward. We look forward to the blessed hope. In Revelation 19, there's the picture, the metaphor of marriage, where what do? We have a huge feast, a huge celebration. What is it? It's the marriage supper of the Lamb between Christ, the groom, and the church, his bride. The party is a marriage party. And even Paul points to this this marriage metaphor, and he does that in Romans 7, right smack dab in the middle, when he's talking about relationship with God and the law. He says this, likewise, my brothers, you also have died to the law through the body of Christ so that you may belong to another. When he says belong to another, he's just got done wrapping up a whole conversation about married men and married women and their relationship and what happens if someone, a wife dies, then it goes to the husband. Very Jewish law-y, but it's all about union and marriage and adultery and commitment. And he says, the same way we belong to another, to him, to Jesus, who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God. And right here, Paul is nailing exactly what James is talking about. How do I live a life submitted to God? Well, I recognize that my covenant marriage metaphor and that God is my groom and I am his wife, right? Seems weird to say, right? But we are in a marriage relationship with God. This metaphor changes everything. And it is out of that marriage that I am going to, it's going to produce righteous living and the fruit of the Spirit. And Paul said, or James goes on to say, is that when he says, you know, not only does he call us adulteresses, but he goes on in this little passage to say, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. And what James is saying, he's not just saying, hey, you're a pal with the world. He's saying a friendship is the equivalency of cheating on. We are sleeping with the world. We are sleeping with and we are committing adultery on our beloved and our marriage. And so, that's what he says. We, his people, are an unfaithful wife who befriends or loves the world. And so, the question then becomes is, why is James using this metaphor? Why is he starting here? Well, he starts here because of there's three really key components to this marriage metaphor that will, if we really grasp it, it'll transform the way we live, it'll transform the way which we approach even the book of James and all the things that he tells us to do and not to do, and then so that we can live a life submitted to God. Right? And so there's three things. So the first thing we're going to look at is that marriage is a loving choice. And let me ask you this, who's married in the room? Any married folk? Okay. What usually, how do you end up married? What usually precedes the actual act of marriage? Huh? Yeah, there's a little bit of courtship in there, right? Yeah. If you don't know what that is, you know, I don't know what to tell you, right? Yeah. So, I think I know what it is. Yeah, but yeah. And then you, usually what do? You fall into what? You fall in love, right? Normally, right? You fall in love. Hopefully that's the case for everyone here, right? You fall in love, and then that's what the kind of the, then you get married, right? Now, marriage is not really a business proposition, right? No one's not like, we're going to say, we're going to get married because this is great for business, we're going to make millions of dollars, right? Normally, it is that you fall in love. And so the first thing we got to recognize about this marriage metaphor is that marriage starts with being in love. And then when we are in love, how many of you become romantic poets? Any romantic poets in the room? You're like, hey, I see the wives are like looking at their husbands like, hey, that was, yeah. Right? We kind of, when we start out, when we fall in love with someone, we kind of do irrational things, right? My wife continues to kind of poke fun at me, and she's like, you know, it was like 9 days, and you told me that you love me. I was like, will you shut up? I'm like, I look back, and I'm like, 9 days? What the? That's very irrational. Like, what was I doing? You know. You know, we do irrational things. We make cosmic proclamations about stuff. Anyone like a good love song, right? We write poetry and write songs about them, right? There's famous songs like Etta James, and we're like, you know, at last. And she goes on to say, my life is but a song now. Every day is a song. For those of you who are married and in love, is every day a song? Like, yes, the answer is yes. Okay, yeah, if you're sitting next to your spouse, yes, every day. Right, Marvin Gaye, right, there's no mountain high enough, no valley low enough, no river wide enough that's going to keep me from you because I love you. I'm pretty sure the Himalayan mountains are a pretty significant barrier to me getting to my love at some point, right? Am I going to swim across the ocean? No. Of course not. Meatloaf. If you don't know who Meatloaf is, anyone not know? I know, I'm very old, I'm getting old, right? Meatloaf says, I would do anything for love. And he literally says, I'll run to hell and back, right? The very fact that we are quoting someone, a grown man who goes by the name of Meatloaf, is all the proof we need that is nothing but irrational ridiculousness when we fall in love, okay? We become irrational, and we actually are pretty much lying to each other. We're like, this is not, I'm saying these things, but there's no possible way I can do this, right? That's what we do. Marriage is a loving choice. Now, this is the first step in our, James is reminding us of saying, you have a beloved in heaven. You have someone, this marriage, you did not just enter into, Christianity is not entering into a business relationship with God. It starts with, I love this person. I love God. I love Jesus. I am in love with Jesus. Which is sometimes a metaphor that we don't necessarily kind of fully embrace. And what are all of these irrational human-to-human proclamations doing? Yeah, they're irrational, but what are they doing? They are actually expressing a very deep, innate longing that every single human being has to say, I know it's crazy, but I wish these things were true. I wish there would be nothing that would prevent me from coming to you. I wish I could run to hell and back for you. What is it doing? It's actually expressing a very deep, innate longing in every human being to say, I wish these cosmic things were true. And when James is pointing us to a marriage metaphor that says, you know what? I understand that this is kind of crazy interpersonally, but you actually have, remember, you have a groom, you have a beloved who actually does all of that stuff. Every day is actually a song when we go to heaven. It's like we're just singing wonderful songs. He actually says that you can actually, in the name of Jesus, throw a mountain into the ocean, right? There is literally no mountain too high. Jesus literally walks on water. There is no physical boundary that prevents God's love from actually pursuing us and finding us. And not Meatloaf. Meatloaf didn't walk into hell and back. Jesus literally walked into hell and back because he loves us. James is saying, remember the fact that your marriage to God starts with being in love, and you have somebody who, a lover that is far beyond anything you'd ever want and far beyond anything you can imagine and fulfills every single innate desire that we have as humans. And so he starts there. Marriage is a loving choice. He goes on, the next thing in this metaphor that shapes the way in which we live. He says, marriage is founded on commitment and vulnerability. Right? So I know that many times when we're talking with people who maybe first put their faith in Jesus, They ask the question, okay, well, now that I put my faith in Jesus, how do I live? What do I then do? Like, how shall we then live, essentially, is the question. What do I do? How do I live? Right? And so when we think of how do I live a life submitted to God, that's a very similar question. How do I actually live a life where, and James is pretty much answering that, saying this is how you do it. But the question is, well, why is James pointing to a marriage metaphor if all he wanted to do was just tell us to follow a bunch of rules? And he says a key component is that marriage is founded on commitment and vulnerability. And marriage resolves this tension for Christians between the idea of how do I walk a legalistic life where I'm following the rules while also walking in gospel freedom, where I'm not doing it because I have to do it. I'm not doing it because that's how I self-justify, or I stand before God saying, look at all the wonderful things I've done and all the rules that I've followed. Aren't you pleased with me? But in our interpersonal human marriage relationships, the question we're essentially asking is, well, how do I live? Well, the real question is, like, when you fall in love, why do you do the things that you do? Why do you do the things you do when you fall in love with someone? Many times, what we do is the reason we are doing things to the person that we love and our spouse that we're in a marriage relationship with is because we want to bring a smile to their face, right? We want to please them. And many times, the joy of being, of falling in love and getting to know someone is that you are constantly looking for the things that that person loves, the passions of their heart, so that you can run to meet those passions willingly, right? And so this works out, this is kind of what happened in my marriage, before and after we got married, but Jules is a gifted baker, right? She makes delicious things, and she found out that I have a sweet tooth. I love sugar, okay? I literally cannot eat a meal. I got to have some sort of sugar afterwards. I know, I have no self-control whatsoever, right? So the question is, but then she also found out that I have a passion if given the option of a fruit-based dessert or a chocolate-based dessert, which one am I choosing? Chocolate. Who chooses fruit? Oh boy. All right. Yeah. Or how many of you are just like, yes, right? Yeah. Right. Nothing ruins my day than going and seeing a nice chocolate cake and I'm colorblind, so I bite into it and there's a layer of like cherry or raspberry or something. I'm like, oh my gosh. So I got a passion. My wife finds out, a woman who loves me finds out, and so suddenly, you know, baked goods are appearing, like delicious chocolate things. Now, it takes my wife a lot of time to make that kind of stuff. There's a lot of intentionality that goes in there. But what is the principle? The principle is this, is that marriage is founded on commitment and vulnerability. And what's commitment? Commitment is that I am willfully giving up my independence. She likes fruit-based desserts, okay? Can't believe I married her, but whatever, you know. She likes them. She would rather make a fruit-based dessert, but she does it. She willingly gives up her independence and makes me a chocolate-based dessert, right? So, but in a marriage commitment, I say I find their passion, what they love, and I'm willfully running to meet that. Essentially willingly giving up my independence. And the vulnerability is that she is doing it out of love and affection for me. She's not, her behavior is not formed by and being controlled by fear, where if Yon doesn't give me a chocolate-based dessert, man, he's going to be upset with me, right? He might kick me out of the house, which might be true, but, you know, whatever. Well, not really. But we're not living, and we're not controlled by fear in our marriage relationship. And so this, when we think of this, the reason James is this part of this marriage metaphor is so important is because it radically changes the way in which we view our relationship and the things that James and the way we approach God's law and the things James is asking us to do, because this is what happens. Timothy Keller says this. He says, Christians see every one of God's laws as an expression of the passions of our beloved. When you fall in love, you want to find what that person is passionate about, and I want to run towards it. And the marriage metaphor, instead of it being a king with decrees or a shepherd telling me where to go, it is a marriage in that it is a beloved telling me, this is what I love and what I'm passionate about, and I'm going to run to meet those things. So when God says, thou shalt not lie or bear false witness, what is he saying? It's a declaration of the fact that my beloved God is passionate about truth. He's passionate about justice. He's passionate about these things. And out of that, we can willfully run towards it. We give up our independence to say, that's a beautiful thing, my beloved. I'm going to work towards it. And I'm going to do it not because God's going to be upset with me or he's going to judge me or I'm afraid, but because that brings a smile to his face. When we see God's law in a romantic lens, and I understand, you know, sometimes even as, you know, as a guy talking about a romantic lens with God, like, it seems a little strange, but this metaphor is so critical to grab, is that if we see it through the romantic lens, it changes the way we approach God's law and how we submit to it. The reason that we behave, the reason we do all the things that James is telling us is to do, is because if we don't, we view it as we are breaking God's heart. We're breaking our beloved's heart. And if you are in a marriage relationship with someone you love, you never want to break their heart. We want to put a smile on their face. But I know for many of us, the idea of committing to something is a difficult thing to do, right? The idea of willfully giving up our independence is something that is even a little bit countercultural right now, right? When you idea of getting married and saying, I gotta live for somebody else. I once had one of Jules' grad school friends was in our house, and he said, oh, what's marriage like? And I was like at a pastor mode or something. I was like, well, it's the daily dying of yourself to give up to the other person. You know, he goes, that sounds terrible. I was like, well, I guess I could have framed it a different way. Maybe that's like, you know, that's like the fourth session of premarital counseling as opposed to the first, right? Right. But right, the idea of like willfully giving up your independence in marriage or having kids or even a job and saying, I want to give up my freedom to commit to something, you know, that's not, you know, there is a level of fear in saying, I don't want to do that. I would rather just do what I want. And I understand that there's the idea that you would be vulnerable is filled with people who have experiences where they actually were vulnerable to humans, to other human beings. And what happened? They were abused horribly, treated horribly. And so the invitation to say, hey, be vulnerable, it's like, be vulnerable? You don't know what people have done to me. You don't know the abuse that I have taken. Why would I do that? I would never do that. So the idea of saying, commit yourself, willingly give up your independence, and also show up with a level of vulnerability is not an attractive proposition for many people. But why? Why can we trust this beloved Jesus different than we can trust any other human relationship? Well, it's for this reason, is that we have a beloved who we abused. In this marriage relationship, it is we are the abuser and he is the victim. We have a beloved who left heaven, left immortality and became mortal, became invulnerable to vulnerability. And what did we, his bride, do to him? We mocked him, we cursed him, and we killed him. And even as we're Christians, even as we are sons and daughters of God, many of us still abuse our beloved in that when do we spend time with our beloved groom? When we need something. Have you ever been in a relationship where someone's just only time you talk to them was when they say, hey, can you help me out with this? Can you help me out with that? Help me out with this? Many times you would talk to someone and they say, get those relationships away from you. They're toxic. But we have, that is many times the way we approach our relationship with our beloved. And so why can we trust this invitation to commit and give up our independence and be vulnerable, because our beloved is on the receiving end of abuse from us, and he still loves us. He loves us beyond anything else. Arms wide open, constantly pursuing us, constantly fulfilling those grand cosmic propositions that we make when we're in love. James is inviting us to remember that we have a beloved who will never stop loving us and is constantly living wide open and wants to put a smile on our face. So we have the first piece of the metaphor is it's a loving choice. When we fall in love, we become a little bit irrational and we make these big propositions, but only our beloved Jesus can fulfill those deepest inner longings. Secondly, there's a level of commitment and vulnerability. And third, the third piece is marriage is marked by passionate intimacy. Okay. Now, when we fall in love and when we get married, we run to fulfill the passions of our beloved, the person we love, find out what they love, fill those passions to put a smile on their face. Many times, we also run to something else. We run to some passionate intimacy. And this is what I love about the biblical metaphor, is that the Bible does not shy away from even extending the metaphor into a sexual metaphor. And what happens when we get into marriage relationship? We fall in love, we become committed, we become vulnerable, and it is marked, a marriage is marked by passionate intimacy, right? We run towards passionate intimacy, which in a marriage relationship is many different things, right? Intimacy and passionate intimacy is emotional, right? By spending time with each other. There's also physical intimacy, which is sex. And so how many of you have done like the five love language? Anyone done that thing, right? What are your love languages? So intimacy shows up in different ways. I've yet to meet a man who doesn't have the physical touch love language, okay? And I've maybe yet to have a woman who doesn't have the quality time, all right, love language, okay? So if you just start with that as a baseline, you'll be safe, okay? There's a level of passionate intimacy. And one of the things that we realize in marriage is when you get married, and one of the kind of the principles in Christian marriage is that there's no passion without commitment. Okay? That's a principle. You can't, like, no deep emotional entwinement or physical sex without a committed monogamous relationship, right? Conversely or similarly, there is no commitment without passion. That's another biblical principle around marriage. It's not like suddenly I've made a commitment and now the business relationship starts. Suddenly it's like I'm not driven only by duty and commitment to doing certain things for my wife. There is a level of passionate intimacy that is supposed to be maintained throughout our marriage and throughout this marriage. And when you look specifically at, well, when you look at marriage, okay, you have physical intimacy. You look at, well, what is physical intimacy? It is a perfect representation of commitment and vulnerability. Vulnerability in that when you show up and you have sex with someone, you're usually naked. What's more vulnerable than that? Right? I mean, later on in this passage, Paul says, or James says, resist the devil. And the same word resist is the same word he uses when Paul talks about putting on the armor of God, right? So there, when you think of resisting the devil, you're cladding yourselves in armor. When you think of what James is inviting us to do in this metaphor, make yourself vulnerable. Make yourself naked. I don't need anyone cook naked? We don't even cook naked, right? Because it could splash on you. It could hurt. So there's a level of vulnerability, but there's physical vulnerability. There's emotional vulnerability. Like, it's not like January in central New York when I can put 45 layers on, right? And suddenly weather gets warmer and I'm like, oh God, I have to take my shirt off in a pool sometime. I can't hide anything. People are going to think I'm undisciplined or whatever, right? So there's physical, there's emotional, there's all sorts of vulnerability that shows up. And when you have sex with someone, the natural consequences of not working is like a child, right? And specifically, a child is a lifelong commitment that you say, we're going to raise this child into adulthood and care for them, right? So there's no better description of the idea that we are of intimacy, passionate intimacy, when the metaphor of human sexuality, right? And why does this matter? Why are we talking about sex on Memorial Day weekend, right? Well, it matters because what James is telling us is that this metaphor carries on even to the idea that we are to have a passionate intimacy, not only in our marriage life that shows up. Again, this is hard to do when you're married. I got three little kids, all right? It's hard to spend time with my wife. I come home from work, and I got a couple of little boys. I love it. They run right at me, right? And they're just like, papa, papa. And it's like, if I don't be intentional, even about like being like saying hi to my wife, suddenly I've spent 30 to 45 minutes playing with my kids, and I haven't even said a word to my wife, right? And then when they're all in bed, then it's like, all right, let's just lay here and half asleep, because this is our only time to veg out a little bit, right? Even the idea of spending time with our spouse in the grand scheme of things, that passionate intimacy, that emotional intimacy, physical intimacy, it's difficult to maintain. And what James is saying, it's not just about a commitment to following a bunch of rules. There is a deeper level of relationship that God is calling us to do. And this is the source of righteous and right behavior. He is saying that in the same way that we have passionate intimacy with our spouses on earth, there is that same level of passionate intimacy that we have with God in our marriage relationship with Him. And what does that look like? We would ask the question, what does your prayer life look like? Are you showing up and asking God for a bunch of stuff? Or are you in prayer where you are burying your heart? Like, what is that? What does intimacy look like with God? Are you burying your soul, laying down, here's all the things I'm struggling with. Here's all my hopes. Here's all my dreams. Are we spending time reading about this God, talking with our God, praying and saying, what does that look like in our lives? Where we spend our time is a great indication of how much passionate intimacy we have with our beloved. And what James is really saying is that as great as our physical relationships are and our marriage relationships and that passionate intimacy, what he's saying is that passionate intimacy exists and it's available to us with our God. And it's better than anything we could imagine. We are not just bound to living a life of commitment to follow a bunch of rules. We have a beloved that we can be intimately involved with, bearing our soul. They know he knows us, and we know him, and it will radically transform our lives. And why does it transform our lives? Because it's the same thing that Paul said. Is that in the same way that when we have union as a married couple, there is something birthed, and that is offspring. In our relationship with God, in our marriage relationship, we have union, and out of that, something is birthed. And the question is, what are we having union with, and what is being birthed into the world? Are our behaviors a result of deep, passionate intimacy with God, with our beloved, so that the fruit of that is beautiful, fruit of the Spirit, and righteous living, and all the things that James is asking us to do? Or are we having intimacy? Are we friends with the world? And are we bearing sin and unrighteousness into the world? Because the other thing Paul is telling us is that we are not left with an option of, am I going to be married to God or married to nobody? Am I going to have intimacy with God or am I going to have intimacy with nobody? No, what he's telling us is that everyone is intimate with something. We are all intimate with something. Or someone. It's either going to be God, our beloved, and then out of that relationship we are birthing righteous living and beautiful fruit of the Spirit, or we're going to be passionately intimate with something else, and we're going to birth all sorts of sin and brokenness into the world. If I have passionate intimacy with Jesus, my beloved, I show up with hope and joy, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. Sound familiar? Or I show up with something else. I show up with worry, anxiety, jealousy. These are the things that I am birthing into the world. And these are the behaviors that I am embracing. And so when James tells us these lists of things that we should be doing, how do I submit to God? How do I humble myself? How do I resist? How do I draw near to God so he draws near to me? He's saying, remember your beloved. Dr. Timothy Keller says, if you understand the lover and friend you have, you won't allow the world to be your lover and friend ever again. And so, as a Christian, James is writing this book to Christians. He's writing this letter to the church. And he is saying we're all doing this. But again, in that passage it says, but God gives more grace. We have a lover who stands with his arms wide open, who constantly pursues us, who loves us regardless of how much we abuse him. So James is not chastising us to say, how dare you, or you are hopeless, follow these rules and then you'll be better. He's just reminding us of this beautiful beloved that we have and saying, look to him. Remember your first love. Remember your commitment and vulnerability. Remember that you can actually have passionate intimacy and spend time with him, sing about him, read about him, and pray with him. And I know there's probably people in this room or listening who, again, you have not yet made that commitment. You're not. You said, I'm not interested in that. I want to be in dependence on God. I don't want to be vulnerable to God. I don't want to be married to this God. I would prefer to be able to do whatever I want and do my own thing. Well, we would invite you to think about the fact that there's a beautiful, beautiful supper, dinner, party, celebration that we're all going to have together at the marriage supper of the Lamb called the Great Dance. We're going to have this incredible marriage feast with our beloved. And it's beyond anything that we can ever think or imagine. And we're just saying, don't miss that dance. Don't miss that marriage for one of these lesser marriages. And for the church, don't miss this beautiful, passionate, life-changing, transforming marriage that you have with Jesus for a lesser marriage, for something that's not going to meet the deepest desires of your heart, or it's not even going to get you where you want to go or in terms of living a life submitted to God. Don't miss the beautiful, beloved marriage that we have with Christ for these lesser marriages. And so what do we do with this? Here's what we invite you to do. I love what Pastor Jonathan said. I love our theology of worship here and the fact that we sing songs not about how we love God. We sing songs about how our beloved loves us. And so we're going to sing a couple songs. Here's what I invite you to do. Just think about the words, sing the words, and ask. Again, you might be dry. You might be like, I got no passion left in me. It's been a while, right? You might only be relating to God through the king metaphor. Like, I'm just kind of trying to follow a bunch of rules. Think on this metaphor. Let the Holy Spirit speak to your heart and remind you of the beauty of Jesus and the beauty of that relationship. Sing these words and let it soak into your soul as a new rekindling of your love and your affection for Jesus. So let's stand up and let's sing together this morning.